Aspiring Republican politicians and conservative opinionators love talking in darkened tones about the malevolence of elites. And yet, for all the fingers wagged and pixels rendered, conservatives have largely ignored the most economically significant way in which elites actually have rigged the game in their favor. The widening gap between elites and the rest of us comes down in large part to the highly abnormal way in which the United States has defined money for the last 50 years. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, audio nuts? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible, where you will learn everything there is to know about Bitcoin from all of the people who know it, narrated and expanded upon by yours truly, Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We have got a piece from returning author Avik Roy, and I say returning author because I know I've read his stuff before, but I cannot remember off the top of my head what those things are. I'll see if I can find them and put them in the show notes. But this is a piece from The American Mind, which breaks down in simple terms, this article, the problem with our money, how it originated in 1971, and why it causes a incredibly unfair allocation of all of the wealth and resources that the middle and lower classes produce to the upper classes, merely by their proximity to the debt machine. They get the resources while we get the higher cost of living and the bleeding savings accounts. Avik does a great job breaking it down, so let's go ahead and jump in. But real fast, I want to thank our lovely sponsors. The Bitbox O2 hardware wallet, the digital vault for your digital gold. Swan Bitcoin, the automatic purchase and withdrawal service to secure your Bitcoin future hands-free. And then the Bitcoin 2022 conference. There's going to be tons of announcements for new projects, exciting developments, and so much more. And then we'll get wasted and celebrate how awesome Bitcoin is. Links and discounts in the show notes. But for now, let's get into today's read, and it's titled, "Want to Stick It to Coastal Elites? Use Bitcoin," by Avik Roy. The digital money revolution is happening. Which side of it are you on? Aspiring Republican politicians and conservative opinionators love talking in darkened tones about the malevolence of elites. And yet, for all the fingers wagged and pixels rendered, conservatives have largely ignored the most economically significant way in which elites actually have rigged the game in their favor. The widening gap between elites and the rest of us comes down in large part to the highly abnormal way in which the United States has defined money for the last 50 years. Our story begins when Richard Nixon, self-styled tribune of the, quote, silent majority, tore up the Bretton Woods Agreement that had linked the value of the U.S. dollar to the price of gold. In 1944, the Allies had all agreed to fix their own currency's exchange rates to the U.S. dollar, based on the American promise that the greenback would maintain its peg to the value of 1/35th of an ounce of gold. The problem for Nixon was that by 1971, the rest of the industrialized world held $64 billion worth of claims on the $10 billion of gold that the U.S. actually held. Nixon solved this problem in Banana Republic fashion, abruptly prohibiting foreign countries from redeeming their dollars for gold, and eventually abandoning the dollar-to-gold peg altogether. For a period of time, this tactic appeared successful. Nixon got reelected in a landslide in 1972. But within 8 years, the dollar's value in gold terms had declined by 95%. And the greenback's purchasing power, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, had been cut in half. What the f*** happened? Many of the economic trends that conservatives now decry stem directly from Nixon's abandonment of the Bretton Woods Agreement. A colorful website, WTFHappenedIn1971.com, compiles a long list of them. Most notably, that while the benefits of economic growth were widely shared among all Americans between 1945 and 1971, after the Nixon shock, they accrued far more to the wealthy. James Grant, the eminent financial commentator, describes interest rates as, quote, the most consequential prices in capitalism. Low interest rates make it cheaper to borrow money. Cheaper borrowing, or easy money in financial parlance, may seem like it benefits everyone, but it doesn't. Instead, it particularly benefits the most creditworthy individuals and institutions, those who already have the ability to borrow in large amounts, banks, investment funds, corporations, and the wealthy. And so, contrary to conventional wisdom on the left and some outliers on the right, the spectacular growth of wealth in inequality is not due to, quote, market fundamentalism. It's instead due to unprecedented federal interference in the interest rate market, a form of dirigism that directly follows from the Nixon shock. In a truly free market, interest rates are determined by billions of independent decisions by lenders and borrowers. Interest rates go up when lenders fear that they won't get their money back, and interest rates go down when lenders worry less about that problem. In contemporary America, interest rates are not determined by the market. They are dictated by the Federal Reserve, and the effects on our economy are profound. When the Fed lends money to banks at near zero interest, those banks then put the money in investable assets, like bonds, stocks, and real estate. Artificially juicing the demand for such assets benefits those who already have them, that is, those with the biggest homes and the largest investment portfolios. It used to be that every middle-class American could afford to own a home. Not anymore, thanks to the run-up in home prices driven by Fed-fueled real estate inflation. The primary method by which the Fed controls interest rates is by manipulating the market for treasury bonds. These bonds are essentially slices of the federal debt. When you purchase a $100 treasury bond, you are effectively lending the U.S. $100. The lower the bond price, the higher the interest rate, and vice versa. Hence, the Fed artificially lowers interest rates by going into the bond market and buying trillions of dollars worth of U.S. debt, making it seem like there is great demand to lend money to America, when in fact, that demand is declining among outside investors. This artificial manipulation of supply and demand by the Fed leads to a critical question. How does the Fed get the money it needs to buy up all of the debt issued by the Treasury Department? By printing it out of thin air. Cheap debt. In case I've made your head hurt, I will try to summarize in plainer English. The United States has incurred $30 trillion of debt. The U.S. borrows money by issuing treasury bonds. Not enough investors believe that lending money to the U.S. yields an attractive return, and therefore, not enough investors are buying treasury bonds. In a truly free market, that set of circumstances would lead interest rates to rise. But if interest rates rise, the government would face higher borrowing costs to finance its debt. And every economically elite American would also face higher borrowing costs, leading to a contraction of markets where financial institutions and wealthy individuals park their excess borrowed cash. The stock market, the venture capital market, the private equity market, the bond market, and the housing market. How does this relate back to Nixon in 1971? Because none of this borrowing would be possible if the U.S. dollar were still pegged to gold. Under a gold peg, the Fed wouldn't be able to artificially increase the quantity of U.S. dollars in circulation, without also increasing the quantity of gold it held in reserve. For most of the past 50 years, there was little that the average American could do to protect himself from this vicious cycle. If you did the responsible thing, living within your means, but didn't have enough to invest in the stock market, your savings declined in value. Even if you made enough to put money in a 401k, rules promulgated by the Securities and Exchange Commission restrict the best investment opportunities to, quote, accredited investors, those with annual incomes over $200,000 or net worths over $1 million. The increasing concentration of capital has enabled an important manifestation of cancel culture, in which coastal elites and the government have increasingly gained the capability to deplatform those whose attributes or views do not comport with those of coastal elites. The most recent example of this phenomenon has occurred in Canada, where citizens have been told that their bank accounts would be frozen if they express support for truckers protesting their government's vaccine mandates. Digital gold. Bitcoin, analogous in some important ways to gold, has emerged as a forceful challenger to all of these trends. To take one point of comparison, like gold, the amount of Bitcoin is finite and fixed. Unlike the US dollar, whose quantity increases every time the Fed snaps its fingers, Bitcoin's software architecture prevents its circulating supply from ever exceeding 21 million. Hence, over the long term, Bitcoin is inflation resistant. Its purchasing power is actually increasing relative to the dollar. Since Bitcoin came online in 2009, its Sharpe ratio, a measure of volatility-adjusted returns widely used by investors, exceeds that of every other asset class in the world. Much as the dollar is divisible into 100 cents, each Bitcoin, worth approximately $38,000 at the time of writing, is divisible into 100 million Satoshis, making an investment in Bitcoin accessible to anyone with even a few dollars in savings to spare. And because the federal government has classified Bitcoin as property, not a security under the jurisdiction of the SEC, anyone in any income bracket can own Bitcoin. These two features enable ordinary Americans to protect themselves from the trends that make everyday life more expensive for everyone other than the wealthiest. As the U.S. debt skyrockets and the Fed prints ever greater amounts of money to fund it, Bitcoin helps people protect their savings from a government-driven erosion of their purchasing power. And it's not just Americans who benefit from Bitcoin. Alex Gladstein of the Human Rights Forum calculates that over 1.4 billion people around the world are living in countries where inflation exceeds 10% per annum, including citizens of Brazil, Turkey, and Argentina. Satoshi versus the Fed. Bitcoin skeptics commonly complain that if Bitcoin can do all of these things, then surely the government will ban it. This gets us to one of Bitcoin's most important qualities. Bitcoin is uncensorable, meaning that any person with an internet connection can send it to someone else, irrespective of whether or not the government wants them to. Elizabeth Warren and Janet Yellen have complained vigorously about this, quote, problem, arguing that only criminals would want to trade in a currency that the government doesn't control. But precisely because governments cannot cancel it, Bitcoin enables regular people and political dissidents alike to protect themselves from government's economic mismanagement. That is not to say that governments can't make it hard to use Bitcoin. The U.S. could tax Bitcoin-driven capital gains at a punitive rate, like 80%, driving many investors away from the asset. The government could make it difficult for Americans to exchange their U.S. dollars for Bitcoin through restrictive banking regulations. Most dangerously, some senior officials in the Biden administration and at the Federal Reserve are considering developing a crypto version of the U.S. dollar called a central bank digital currency. That is exactly the opposite of Bitcoin. A CBDC would enable the federal government to wipe out the private banking sector, because every savings and checking account would reside at the Fed. The federal government would gain the direct authority to add or subtract deposits in those accounts, or even shut them down. Some people still send handwritten notes and read the print copy of their local newspaper. But in a CBDC world, there won't be an option to use plain old paper cash. China is rolling out their own CBDC for the Winter Olympics, with the aim of eventually abolishing paper money. In other words, the digital monetary revolution unleashed by Nakamoto is here to stay. The only question is whether or not the money of the future will serve the interest of governments and elites, or of ordinary people. Bitcoin is resolutely on the side of the latter. All right, and that closes out another excellent piece from Avik Roy, and this one was from theamericanmind.com. Let's take a quick break for our sponsor, and then I want to do a guy's take on this piece. And who do we have today? That is Shift Crypto and the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. So let me give you a recipe here for Bitcoin sovereignty. Step one, buy a Bitbox. Step two, set up your Bitbox. Step three, buy Bitcoin. Step four, withdraw Bitcoin to your Bitbox. Step five, run a node. Step six, connect your Bitbox app to the node. Step seven, repeat step three and four forever. Buy Bitcoin, withdraw to your Bitbox. Getting a simple, secure hardware wallet is by far the best thing you can do for your Bitcoin security, both in the short term and in the long term. If you have not done it yet, these are not the days that you want to get caught with your keys on an exchange. You want them in your possession and yours alone. And when you grab a Bitbox O2 hardware wallet, listeners to this show get a 5% discount with code GUY, G-U-Y, in case you were wondering how to spell that, because it's very confusing and it is a long, complex word. But despite its extreme difficulty, it will get you a 5% discount to start the process of becoming a sovereign Bitcoiner. Go to the link at guyswan.com/bitbox. There's actually a bunch of other great little security accessories and things that they have on their store, and it's 5% everything off everything in your cart. So check it out, guyswan.com/bitbox. Okay, so one of the most important and widely misunderstood elements of the monetary problem that we have in the United States, well, that we have in the world, it's really kind of incredible. The previous century of money has kind of been a test case in how you can distort and manipulate and destroy extremely productive and extremely innovative and fast-moving markets. Markets that would produce an astronomical amount of wealth for everyone if it wasn't for the ungodly amounts of manipulation that is directing it into certain areas and accumulating, where the resources are essentially being sucked up. So Avik mentions the WTF happened in 1971.com. If you haven't checked that out, you definitely need to check it out, just so you can kind of get a visual representation of a lot of the problems that started in the early 70s and just how big the scope of the problem is in comparison to decades and decades before 1970. Like, how could these things be so consistently not present for 30 years prior to it, and then so exaggeratedly present from 70s onward? But if you understand how money works, how money allocates resources, and what it means to have access to money at a different price from the rest of the economy, it's perfectly obvious. It necessitates that this trend would happen. There's no way to avoid it because of the nature of how our system works. And it's not just like one or two little things. It produces a multitude of poisonous effects on the economy. And understand, this is the lack of a free market that has caused this. It is the lack of an actual market for interest rates. And interest rates, by the way, are the price of time. It means what is the cost of using resources today that we could wait a year and use then? And it is always more expensive to wait to use the resources than it is to use those resources today because there's uncertainty. I mean, I might not even be around in a year. Nobody really knows. You know, the conditions of today and right this moment are known. What I can build or construct or do with a certain set of resources or I consume with, you know, a certain amount of food, all of that is known. All of that, the closer it is to me in time, the more valuable it is to me because the more direct and the more clear it is what I can do and what I can get out of it. But in a year, those resources might not be there. You know, even if we keep, you know, a bunch of stuff in like a safe, like secure spot, maybe it's metal and it rusts. Maybe it's food and it rots. Maybe it's, you know, some gold or whatever and it gets hit by an asteroid or the person securing it gets killed or something. Like, who knows? There's so much uncertainty that there must be a premium. That is the interest rate. So an interest rate that is saying, you know, it's 20% to use resources today versus resources in the future means essentially that there are not enough resources for the future. It is a market indication that we are running out of resources and we don't want to use it all up. It's the equivalent of, no, you should not eat your seed today because what we need are to plant crops. We need to save and produce right now so that we have more resources at the end of this year. So a high interest rate means that we are hurting for resources today and we need to stop consuming them. We need to stop using them because it's more expensive. Because obviously it's always going to be easy to do that. We're always going to want to use resources today and not save them for tomorrow. But if we're getting a 20% premium by saving them for a year, we'll actually do that. The market will actually be incentivized to save resources for the future. However, an interest rate of 1% or 0% suggests that we have so much excess value, so much excess wealth and resources that waiting for saving them for the future is pointless because in a year we're going to have so many resources still left over that it's just easy, like, why not? We've just produced so much excess and so much surplus that we can just use as much as we want and consume as much as we want today, and it doesn't really matter because we'll still have plenty in a year. If this was a market price, that's what it would be indicating. So what the hell does it mean when we're in a situation where we are extremely limited on resources, where we obviously have no surplus whatsoever, where debts are astronomical. They're the greatest they have ever been in the history of mankind, and yet we have 0 to 1% interest rates. That is impossible to achieve in a free market without staggering artificial manipulation. There's a quote just after the section where he talks about James Grant talking about how interest rates are the most consequential prices in capitalism. They are the most important price. It's the price of time. Like I said, you know, low interest rates make it cheaper to borrow money, easy money, so quote unquote. But the quote just a little bit further down below that says, in a truly free market, interest rates are determined by billions of independent decisions by lenders and borrowers. Interest rates go up when lenders fear that they won't get their money back, and interest rates go down when lenders worry less about that problem. So that's the thing I was just alluding to, is that interest rates are go higher when lenders are afraid that there aren't enough resources or production to go around to get their money back. So they're going to charge very high rates because they know we're low on resources. They know we're low on productivity, and it's very difficult for someone to just accumulate the resources to pay them back quickly. Whereas if we had so many excess resources, we were just absolutely crammed with surplus at every single corner, well, then a lender would worry a whole lot less about getting the money back. There's plenty of consumers available. Everybody's wealthy. There's plenty of resources to build more production, et cetera, et cetera. There's just a surplus of stuff. So what does it mean when the Federal Reserve is just arbitrarily setting interest rates? When new money is literally created out of thin air in order to produce artificial demand. This goes back to the little section he had on WTF happened in 1971, talking about how while the benefits of economic growth were widely shared among all Americans between 1945 and 1971, after the Nixon shock, they accrued far more to the wealthy. In fact, inflation adjusted, middle and low America has actually been essentially stagnant with economic growth, and now even in the 2010s and on, has even been in decline. In other words, even though we are producing more and the economy is more productive and has grown, we are getting less than we were 20, 30 years ago in proportion of the whole. So how does that happen? Not only that, how does it happen such that it necessitates? Like, how is our system designed such that that is the only way that it can occur? It's explicitly because issuing new debt to the people, to the wealthiest people, to the people who have the most assets, the most equities, and the, you know, the largest institutional capacity in order to pay that loan back. If they can get artificially low interest rates and they can get debt that is issued from nothing, this is the key point. They are able to buy resources from people in a market where the price is still the price of actually having to produce it using money that is backed by no production. Now, that might not make perfect sense yet, but I'm going to come back to it in just a second. Why is it that the wealthy, in this sort of a situation, that the wealthiest are essentially considered the preferred ones to loan to? Why is it that they are the ones who will get like 98% of the loans? And that's, I just pulled that number out of my ass. They get a majority of the loans because they are considered the most loan worthy or the most credit worthy, excuse me, rather than having it distributed evenly across the entire economic pool, which would still be a problem, understand. And we'll get to that again. We'll get back to that in just a second. Even if the poor, the middle class, and the wealthy were evenly distributed loans, it would still be a huge distortion of the economy, and I'll talk about why in just a second. But a major reason why the wealthiest get the preferred access to new debt is because they are buying up the assets and or already have the assets, the equities, the housing, whatever it is, that is always going up in price. But the reason they go up in price is literally a consequence of the fact that we are constantly creating new money. So it is a feedback loop that makes them the most profitable investment from a nominal perspective, because they are getting the benefit from inflation while everyone else is getting the cost of inflation. They essentially become the most reliable, least risky means of return, because the very act of lending to them is going to create inflation, which will make the prices of all of their assets go up, which means they make a return. So, and the wealthy are the ones who own that, so they will see the price rise quickest in the things that they own. It's a self-fulfilling gamble. It's where the act of making the gamble increases your chances of your gamble winning. You're creating the very condition needed for your gamble to work. It's like betting $1 billion that the price of a stock is going to go up, if you don't, except that you don't have the $1 billion, you're just able to place that bet without actually having any reserves or any money to begin with, but then printing $1 billion and buying the stock so that the price of the stock goes up, and then you win on your billion dollar gamble. There's no way to lose, because the very act of what you are doing is bidding up the price of the stock with new money, which means your gamble is always going to pay off. We have this happening economy-wide to the quote-unquote elite. It's why they look like they're so good at everything, is because inflation naturally raises the prices of everything that they own. It's not because they're smart. It's not because they're productive. It's because they're closer to the money printer by the very act of being where they are. This has three massive, disgustingly poisonous consequences to the nature of the economy, to the nature of the market. And it poisons the culture too. When you benefit certain types of productivity, when you benefit a certain culture and behavior that is, you know, some self-fulfilling feedback loop that is completely pointless and separated from any significant any real sense of creating value or creating productivity, well, you just get this degenerative, massive multi-trillion-dollar market of morons, of just utter morons who just are gambling on everything and are professionals at manipulating and accounting to fudge numbers to fake a profit. Because it's not a value profit, it's a nominal profit. It's a numbers go up profit because the number of numbers chasing the stuff has gone up. The money has just been printed. The money is just a number. It's just a tally system. But if you can cheat the tally system, of course you can always make it look like you made a profit. So what are the consequences? What are the consequences of this in the economy? First is that it causes more profit for the wealthy, which fuels inflation because it makes it easier to loan more new money to the wealthy. It is a feedback loop of the wealthy necessarily getting more money, which bids up the prices of what they own, which makes them more profitable and wealthier to get more money, to look better for a loan, to get more money to do the same thing all over again. And the further you are from that, the feedback loop is the opposite. You are getting further and further from being able to afford things, further and further from being creditworthy, and everything about your cost of living and the consumption that you have to do to try to build anything up, or the value of your savings to try to get into that part of the economy, into the wealthy class, is getting harder. Your ladder rungs are getting further and further away while theirs are getting closer and closer. So that's the first thing. Two is it takes the economies of scale of major players. So there's already a productive benefit of having the economy of scale, right? Of having a massive industrial base already built out and the ability to produce things for cheaper because you are producing more of them at one time. If you can only produce one thing, that one thing has to have a significant profit in order to expand and continue production. But if you can produce a billion of those things in a matter of a few days, you can have a much smaller profit margin and still have significant growth. So that's the economies of scale, right? The bigger your production capacity, the lower your price can be offered for your good, because your costs are distributed among a huge amount of production rather than a very small amount. But how does the loan situation, the cheap debt to the wealthy, actually reinforces this? It makes it way, way worse for the people at the bottom, for the people with low amounts of production, with greater benefit to the people who already have the benefit of the economies of scale, the large corporations. Also remember this is an artificial feedback loop, because it creates not only an economies of scale, but an inflation of scale. In other words, not only do they naturally have the lower marginal costs for just more production capacity, but they also unfairly get a lower cost of money itself that reinforces their lower cost of production. So what do I mean by that? It means that there's a limited number of resources in the economy, and everybody's competing for it, right? Let's say there's 10 machines that produce smartphones, and some person with a lot of capacity has 5 of them, and then the other 5 are split up between individual participants. Well, the person with 5 is going to be able to undercut the rest of them, which means that the other 5 need to be, the other individual, the smaller competitors, need to be very agile, and they need to be very smart about their production capacity. But the good thing is that they could actually increase their production faster than the big guy. Like, they could change their production amount because they're smaller, which means that technically they are the better investment because they have more room to grow percentage-wise than the person who is already big. However, if you have an unfair distribution of new loans, if the person with 5 production machines is able to get massive amounts of capital without having to borrow it from anybody who has already produced it, they can simply buy up the other machines or bid up the prices, which increases the production cost for all of the smaller competitors and increases the benefit that the big player gets simply by being big. So where the natural economy would actually limit their economy of scale, would make them run into a wall where Essentially, the changing environment of the economy makes them worse off than a smaller, more agile competitor. They can actually get orders of magnitude bigger than would naturally be sustainable in the market because they can get dirt cheap, nearly free loans. They can just outright purchase smaller competitors with productive capacity and resources that they never even created. It's like a giant vacuum. They're just able to get all of the tally for resources in the economy, the tallies, the money itself, which is just a, like I said, it's like an accounting system. They get the appearance of having all of this new production, which is just actually an illusion. It's just debt for future production. And then they can run around and just buy up all their smaller competitors. And we've seen this over and over and over again. It happened in the 2007-2008 banking crisis. What happened after the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of bailouts? They just run around and consolidated a whole bunch of smaller banks. Like 200 banks turned into like six in a matter of 4 years or something stupid. It didn't bail out the economy. It just made the big, it just heavily, heavily centralized everything about the financial system. Because of this explicit, disproportional access to new money that's just created out of thin air. And the third thing, this was actually a list, the third thing here is that it suffocates smaller entities. So like I said, smaller entities would naturally have far more room to grow. With the debt and production resources needed to expand, if they could get a small loan, they can easily double their capacity. Whereas somebody who's producing 1 billion smartphones can't easily produce and sell 2 billion smartphones, but somebody who can produce 100 can easily sell 200. Whereas in this artificial economy, this artificial monetary environment, the cost of the smaller entities goes up faster than it does for the big entities because the big entities are getting cheap money before the prices go up. They're the ones causing the price rise because they're soaking up all the resources. They're soaking up all the chips and the boards and the machines needed to produce the smartphone. It's why markets start to migrate from being centered around production, from value and competition, to just growing fast enough with enough VC money, with enough cheap debt, so that a massive corporation will just buy you up. It destroys the culture of production and value completely. It becomes a money-chasing game. It becomes a means of chasing the fudged numbers in the accounting system rather than chasing the value being produced, which is supposed to be what makes the accounting system turn out profitable. But if you fuck up the money, it's got nothing to do with production anymore. It's got nothing to do with producing value for somebody. It's about how quickly you can get access to the money before the prices of the resources go up. In a free market, this doesn't happen at all. In fact, the wealthiest, like I said, the wealthiest actually have the smallest margin for growth. If you have a $300 billion company, it's extremely difficult to take money so that you can produce, you know, some new system of innovation or some new smartphone. It's going to be such a breakthrough and so significant that you can turn that $300 billion into $600 billion. It means that you need to take huge amounts of market share from all of your competitors and that you need to make at a massive scale some invention or feature or productive system that can double your capacity. But when you're $300 billion in size, you've already exhausted all of those options. The first thing you did was figure out your 100% capacity increase. Then you figured out the next one if there was still one of those left. Then you went to the 50% capacity increase. After that, after you exhausted all the 100% ones, then you went to the 12% increases, the 2 to 5% increases. The bigger you got, the smaller your increases went. The reason you got to $300 billion is because you exhausted all of the big things that could make you grow extremely quickly. That's how you get that big. You start with the thing that is most profitable and most valuable to your consumers and has the highest consumer space, and then you move down to the next biggest thing, and the next biggest thing, and the next biggest thing, until you're a massive company. But it means that any amount of investment after you are that size is only going to get you a few percent. You've exhausted all the things that get you 20% and 50%. So without a massive leap, that's really, really hard to do now because the company's just too goddamn huge. You've already got too much of the market. On the other hand, somebody who's just got $100 of production capacity can easily, easily double it, maybe even triple it with a really small loan. Smaller scale, more agile companies also respond very quickly to a changing environment, you know, like one full of fast-moving technology and an insanely, rapidly changing landscape. They can move far more efficiently. They can change what they are doing. They don't have all of this bloat. They don't have all of the technical debt. They don't have all of this built-in infrastructure that a massive $300 billion behemoth would have that costs them an ungodly amount of money to change if the environment alters too quickly from what they have their production capacity for. So in a smaller environment, in a free market, the smaller competitor is the better investment. They have the highest return. In an environment where asset prices fall and debt has a real cost, the feedback loop of the rich getting arbitrarily richer and just buying up competitors with free loans doesn't exist anymore. And a fast-moving economy, one that changes rapidly, is a huge benefit to small competitors. Competitors that are highly focused on producing the most value and the most innovative things, rather than just an opportunity for banks to make thoughtless loans to giant corporations who are just going to buy their own stock and raise the price of their stock, which is going to pay off their loan. It's stupid. It's idiotic to think that you can run an economy on this. All you can do is poison it until it eats itself and there's nothing left. And the access that the wealthy have, that these giant corporations have, to unbelievably cheap debt that is attached to no real value just means that they're going to soak up everything that produces any real value until none of it's producing anything anymore. It just becomes a game of chasing assets for the sake of having assets because they go up in price. You don't need to produce anything, you just need to hold assets before the inflation hits. It is a never-ending feedback loop to fewer and fewer, larger and larger institutions that then end up just owning everything in society. And there's a really easy way to illustrate this, and you have to start from first principles. So, and it really involves just a basic understanding of what it means to print a loan. Not take resources that someone else has produced and find a market value to lend those out, but to create a loan out of thin air. Best way to illustrate this is just take the simplest example possible. With just an economy with like three people. You've got Bob, Alice, and Charlie. Now, in a normal free market, nobody in this economy, let's say Charlie is a banker, Bob builds houses and Alice cuts down trees. So obviously, you need savings. You need someone to cut down the trees. Alice has to cut down a bunch of trees before Bob can build a house, right? Those are the savings necessary to construct the house in the first place. And the point of the banker is to vet Bob for his work ethic and the fact that he could actually build a house with the available resources and make sure that Bob gets the loan. He gets the lumber needed to build the house. But understand, Charlie can't lend anything out that doesn't exist in the economy. Alice has to have lumber in his bank in order for his bank to loan out the lumber. And money doesn't make that not the case. All money does is obfuscate the fact that what you're loaning is resources. Because when you loan money, you're just loaning a promise of resources. You're just saying, here's these accounting points that allows you to use somebody else's resources. In the case of loaning to Bob, Bob would be buying Alice's resources. So the effect is the same as if Alice just gave the lumber to Charlie and then Charlie gave the lumber to Bob. But instead, Alice got a tally for the lumber Charlie loaned the tally system to Bob, and then Bob buys the lumber directly from Alice. So the same movement of resources has occurred. The only difference is we shouldn't be moving the lumber constantly. Money is a much easier thing to move, but it is a promise for the resources themselves, which means that if Alice never cuts down the trees, Bob can't build a house, period. This is why every loan must, axiomatically must be backed by savings. For the same reason, you cannot build a house with trees that you haven't cut down. Anybody who tells you that you can create loans out of thin air, that savings are not necessary to create a loan, is simply brainwashed in Keynesian idiocy. It is no different than saying that you can eat a cake before you buy any of the ingredients, or you can buy a house today with the trees that you think you are probably going to cut down next year. In a free market scenario, that is not possible. And the price of money, the price of a loan, would reflect the amount of savings available. In other words, the free market will not start to build 10 houses when there's only 2 houses worth of lumber. A debt market can do that. If you can print loans out of thin air, you can trick people into doing that. And you might call that like a boom and bust scenario, where 10 projects get started, but then after you're 80% of the way through the project, you realize that none of them can actually be finished, and then you have to cancel 8 of those projects. It's almost like at the beginning there's a huge boom and it looks like the economy's growing really, really fast, and then suddenly there's a big crash because everybody got loans for resources that didn't exist. I wonder if there's like an example of this in the real world. Probably nothing. Let's get back to the analogy. So what happens if Charlie makes the loan out of thin air? Understand what this means. Charlie has nothing. He has no savings. He has no value in his bank. He's creating it out of thin air. Let's say the house is going to cost $100,000 to build, I mean. That's how much it's going to cost Bob to buy the resources from Alice and then, you know, buy Alice's labor to build the house because we only have 3 people in the economy, whatever. Now, if there is savings that Charlie has to risk, Alice's savings in this case, in order to loan this money to Bob, loan these resources to Bob to build the house, well, then Charlie's profit is from making a good investment. It's the small amount, it's the portion, the interest rate of Bob's labor and the value that he creates in the house getting paid back, and his risk is still owing Alice the entire amount of the loan and having to pay back Alice. So if Bob doesn't work out, it's on Charlie. Charlie has to pay back Alice. Charlie is the one to get screwed. Well, Alice gets screwed too because she worked with Charlie. But nonetheless, Charlie is the one who has to pay it back. And he can't loan what isn't saved. Now, if he is able to create a loan out of thin air, he can loan Bob $100,000 at, let's say, 10% interest. And Alice never even puts her savings in the bank with Charlie. So if Bob takes those funds and builds a house, who does he owe the house to? In the first scenario, where it's a free market backed by savings, he owes it to Charlie, who owes it to Alice. So the person who used the resources owes it to the person who created the resources. But Charlie is just a middleman. Bob owes it to Alice. Now, what happens when Charlie can create the loan out of thin air? He doesn't have to pay Alice anything. Alice isn't even involved. The production that she did is irrelevant because Charlie is able to print money, which simply bids up the prices of all of the resources in this little economy because now there's twice as much money, or let's say there was $100,000 in the economy when it was natural, and then he loaned another $100,000 into existence. So he's doubled the amount of money chasing the resources and consequently probably doubled the price after a certain amount of time and economic activity has bounced this money around. But here's the thing. Bob, after he finishes building the house, he owes the house to Charlie. Charlie had zero savings. Charlie had zero reserves in his bank. He printed a loan out of thin air and gave it to Bob. And Bob built an entire house of which Alice created all of the resources for, and the entire thing is owed to Charlie. And Charlie owes it to nobody. In fact, it's owed to Charlie with interest. So Charlie technically went from dead broke to having a house plus interest for no other reason than he has the political authority to create a loan out of thin air. It's counterfeiting. It is counterfeiting 100% from bottom to top, through and through. It is just stealing. Charlie printed himself a house that Alice made the resources for and Bob built, and Charlie owns it. That is the fundamental way that our money works. And you wonder why banks are the largest buildings in every city. You wonder why the political apparatus just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You wonder why the wealthy just keep getting wealthier, and they get access to loans that are damn near free, and they just, nothing can stop them. They just keep growing and consuming more, and we get fewer and fewer consolidation, fewer and fewer large centralized institutions that own more and more of the economy and buy up more and more of the smaller competitors, until we're just a giant group of like a handful of conglomerates and one massive financial infrastructure and culture of gambling and just degenerate idiocy, where everybody just fudges numbers and chases loans and sucks the dicks of politicians. The culture has rotten into nothingness. The financial system is bleeding the economy of all resources, and we're in the greatest debt bubble in the history of mankind. You do that by fucking with the money. We live in an economy that is the equivalent of Charlie and all of his cronies and all of his political friends basically buying up the entire economic pool of resources, simply because they are standing next to the dude who has the pen that allows them to print money out of thin air. And it's not better that it's a loan versus just printing it to counterfeit. It's the exact same thing. In fact, arguably it's worse as a loan, because it gives the appearance of Charlie being virtuous, being helpful to Bob in providing him with the loan, even though Charlie is creating the loan for his own value and his own wealth. He just got an income and a house for free, whereas if he was just counterfeiting, it would at least be obviously disingenuous. But the process isn't any different, except that the loan is going to be called due, and mathematically, the loan will never actually, you're always going to create more loans than you actually have money for. Because every time you create a new loan, you need more money to pay it off. So if you're creating a loan, if there's $100,000 in the economy and you create a loan of $100,000 with 10% interest, well then what you're doing is you're constantly requiring people to catch up. The amount owed is always the interest rate above what amount of money exists. So there's always going to be a collapse. There's always going to be this boom and bust cycle where more people are starting projects and believe that there's value in the economy, there are resources available, that there are trees that are already cut down in order for them to safely start a housing project, when in reality, you can only actually build half of the houses that we have started. But because the economy is so big, so obfuscated, and there's so much financial trickery going on and monetary manipulation, it's not evident yet. We don't notice it because there's a huge, huge pool of resources that will take a decade to go through before we realize, shit, we're out of resources. We can't build any more of these houses. About half of the projects that we started must close. We must shut these things down because there is not enough lumber to go around. And that's when the collapse comes. And what happens during the collapse? All of the money and all of the resources flows back to the wealthiest, and the biggest pain, the biggest cost flows to the middle class and the poor. And why do all the resources go to the bankers? Why do they all go to the financial system? Because they're the ones who own it. When Bob starts building a house in order to pay to have the profit to pay off the previous loan, and they have to close the project, Charlie gets the house. Charlie gets Bob's house. Not because Charlie built the made the resources or cut down the trees, not because Charlie built the house with his own hands, not because Charlie even gave 1 hour of labor to anything involved in creating the house, but simply because Charlie created the loan out of thin air that represent the value of the house that Bob owes to him. Charlie was always going to get the house the second he printed that money, one way or another. Welcome to the fiat economy. It is a cancer, and society will never thrive as long as it exists. We will be stuck in a cycle of stagnancy, of bloated finance, of an increasingly rotten culture of gambling and nihilism, in a never-ending series of boom-bust cycles where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, until it just completely collapses at the end of 40 years of chaos and pain, or until we switch to a money that cannot be cheated. Bitcoin fixes this. If you want to end this cycle, you leave the dollar. You exit fiat. Because that is where the source of the problem is. And so many of our issues are simply derived from that core problem. It is not an exaggeration when we say fix the money, fix the world. It is hard to understate how many of our problems are caused by the unequal, no skin in the game access to debt, which allows political institutions and financial institutions to soak up all of the resources of everybody producing them. How can you fight something that can just command all of your time and energy without you even knowing it? Fiat money is a disease, and it is time we stick that shit in the history books, close it, weld it shut, and never touch it again. Damn it, I hope Bitcoin is the thing that is going to do that. I guess that'll close this. Thank you guys for listening. This one got heated. This one got fun. Of all the things, economics is the thing that gets Guy riled up. All right. Thank you to Avik Roy for this piece. The American Mind. They have a lot of great stuff. I bump into some good articles from over there from time to time. Definitely check them out. I have links to all this good stuff in the show notes. Yeah, big thanks to our amazing sponsors, the Bitbox O2 Hardware Wallet, Swan Bitcoin, StackSats Automatically, and the Bitcoin 2022 Conference right around the corner. It's about to get crazy, guys. Don't miss it. With that, thank you guys. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to the Audionauts for supporting me, for having been supporting me for so long, and all the things that I do here in Bitcoin, and I love it. I really, really appreciate you guys, and I don't say it enough. Don't forget to subscribe. Bitcoin Audible, baby. And follow me on Twitter at TheGuySwan. Bitcoin is going to change the damn world. I hope you guys are f***ing ready. Exit fiat, enter Bitcoin, and I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, guys, take it easy. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.